Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Fringe Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Michael Morris. Let's get into the first news story of today, and this is about the ANC's internal machinations. We've talked about this a little bit over the past couple of weeks, but the ANC has announced for both KZN and Gauteng a new committee, which is going to supposedly revive the fortunes of the party in KZN and Gauteng, which are the two provinces where the ANC took an absolute hammering in the last election. Over the past couple of days, we had the announcement of who was going to run KZN, but today we've had the announcement of who's going to run Gauteng. And this is so typical kind of how the ANC tries to solve problems. The ANC has put together a 68-member provincial structure, which they say features veteran politicians and as well as reshuffled members from various factions to guide the party into the next local government elections. It's called the PTT. I can't remember what that stands for, but the idea is that this thing is supposed to reinvigorate the party's structures and allow them to properly fight the next election. The Gauteng structure is seeing a dilution of Panyazo Lesufi's power within the ANC, because he now has to share control over the ANC in Gauteng with Amos Masondo, who was a mayor of Joburg from 2001 to 2011 and was also in the National Council of Provinces. Some people in the thing have just stayed the same. Others are new people who have been brought in by the ANC. But what really struck me about this is that this seems to be an absolute recipe for gridlock and infighting and just endless meetings to find consensus on everything. It's very rare that having co-leaders of anything is a way to have some kind of decisive action or improve the efficiency of an organization. And I think this kind of speaks to an ANC which is so consumed by its own internal battles that it can't actually ever make a decisive decision. Are you going to support Lesufi? Are you going to support Fikile Mbalula, who tried to get rid of Lesufi? Apparently neither. The party's just going to sort of blunder on with this huge, unwieldy group of people who presumably are all going to spend their time undermining each other. Michael, what do you make of this?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the first thing that strikes one, coming a few days after the SRF, the Social Research Foundation's analysis polling showing the ANC at 32%. It kind of makes sense. This is a party that can't bring itself to be so decisive as to say, right, we're appointing X to do X job. You form this sort of committee, this ungainly process, which is meant to be streamlining the organization, is doing the very reverse. It's, as you say, it's unlikely that it's going to produce any more kind of decisive thinking about anything in particular, and much more likely to be kind of generating internal conflict and disputes. And as I was saying in our chat before the show, if you have a look at the Daily Maverick story on this, and I recommend you're doing so, they have their graphics department has put together a masterly piece of work in a kind of agglomerated image of five individuals, including Amos Masondo and others, Jeffrey Debe among them, veterans all, each face actually conveys a kind of sense of exactly what it must be like to be in the ANC at the moment: uncertain, slightly baffled, lacking confidence, not really knowing what's going to happen next or what it is that any of them can actually do. This may be entirely unfair. I'm reading a lot of stuff into what are, after all, simply photographs, but it does seem to reflect exactly what we're talking about. And as you say, Nicholas, highly unlikely that producing, or giving these two provinces, which are both very important to the performance of the ANC, but also a very important symbols for the party nationally, giving them giving them a situation where they have to now choose between listening to one or listening to the other, people who are very likely to be contenders, for attention and for power and all the rest of it, does not strike one as a recipe for any kind of solution seeking. Quite an unfortunate turn of events. But I think the other thing which maybe you'd like to begin talking about, Nicholas, is also your point about how this is so reminiscent of the 1980s. And I think that's
so I wasn't around for the 1980s, but I was saying to you, but just before the show started, that towards the end of the Nats, they had this complete internal. They became very internally focused when there was the rebellion by the conservative wing of the National Party, and Botha, who had promised to reform the country in a bunch of ways, he sort of didn't go the full way in reforming things, because I think he became consumed with this fear that there was going to be this alternative power source within the NP that was going to challenge him. He had to hold them off, which meant he had to put his foot on the brake of the reforms and all these kind of things. And that eventually led to this power struggle that ended up with de Klerk becoming the president of South Africa. But sort of looked at from a historical perspective, it seems sort of so weird, because we know that from the research that we did, that apartheid was really crumbling at that stage. The sanctions were hitting the economy. There was unrest all over the place. There was mass disobeying of various apartheid laws by businesses and individuals across the country. So the whole thing was headed for, there needed to be some kind of either the country needed to turn into some kind of fascistic military dictatorship at full bore with, full militarization of the entire population, or it needed to reform and become a democratic state. There was no way of keeping the status quo. And yet the whole party got consumed with this sort of internal fight over, whether we're going far enough or too far, whatever. And that really strikes me as similar to the ANC right now. The ANC, you look at Ramaphosa, right? That same SRF poll that came out on Monday said that without Ramaphosa leading the party, the ANC might be looking at somewhere in the 20s in terms of electoral support, 21% of the vote. That would be catastrophic for the party. It may never recover from a blow like that. And yet Ramaphosa seems, and we can see it in the decision he's just made here on these provincial councils here, to be focused on appeasing the ANC's internal factions. It's as though, Panyaza Lesufi and that sort of, I don't know what to call it, the no brakes on the looting train kind of ANC, the sort of nationalize everything, racialize everything. We just need to triple down on everything front of the ANC is losing the argument so badly. They've been in the driver's seat since at least 2008. And the country has gotten poorer. The country's crime has gone up. All these measures have just gone down. And yet the ANC is still so obsessed with appeasing this faction. Ramaphosa is the only reason that people are still voting for the ANC in large part. If he took them on, and he could have done this, I think he even had a stronger hand perhaps to do this back in 2017. He could have actually turned the ANC in a direction that was in embracing real reform, real change, real economic growth. But instead, he's just mucked about and kept things on the back burner and juggled and kicked cans down the road and sought consensus and sort of fudged around the edges. He spent half his time in the GNU trying to undermine the DA to get them to almost walk out of the thing. This really brings home the ultimate failure of him as a leader, is that he had the opportunity in his hands. He was popular. He had the political capital. He had everything going for him to be a transformational leader in South Africa's history. And he's wasted it all. He's wasted it all and doubled down on the National Democratic Revolution. So I think that will ultimately be history's judgment of him. Although, many things can happen between now and whenever he's, no longer our president or no longer in charge of the ANC. So I guess there's still a third act potential for some sort of comeback here, but I'm very skeptical of that. Any final thoughts, Mike, on that?
And I agree with that. And one of the things I was thinking about just as you were talking was P.W. Botha, with all the speculation, the very very optimistic speculation prior to his very famous address to the National Party conference in Natal in 1985, P.W. Botha flying around the world well, certainly to the capitals that mattered, Washington and London, to say, look, just, you know, chill for a moment. We've got really good news coming. There's going to be this major speech in Durban. And I can assure you privately, you know, don't say anything yet, but this is going to mark a big, big change. And when and his staff were helping to write the speech, and you know, everything was looking good. The signs were that P.W. Werter was now beginning to see the light. He kind of got the initiative and so on. And then, of course, came the Rubicon speech, where he rejected that version of the speech and wagged his finger at the world and said, "Don't push us around." And that, of course, led directly to Chase Manhattan Bank pulling out and the stiffening of sanctions. Everything just got tougher. So that was, I mean, that was, I wouldn't necessarily compare P.W. Werter with Ramaphosa, but certainly leadership position, you kind of key point where you can make a bold decision and you turn away from doing it. I think this is certainly a problem with Ramaphosa as well. And it's just something that you mentioned also in our chat beforehand was how, you know, in a sense, how insignificant the Conservative Party was, the right-wing Conservative Party in the old Parliament, and how that was, you know, but and yet how P.W. Werter paid so much attention to that, so anxious about his right. But then came the true reflection of this kind of national sentiment, brought out much more cleverly by F.W. de Klerk in 1992, when he called a referendum, but instead of turning it into a choice between the kind of Afrikaner interests or right-wing interests or National Party interests, he made it broad enough to incorporate all of the left or the liberal opposition on the Democratic Party, but also implicitly the ANC. Nelson Mandela was felt bound to say, I don't agree with white-only politics, but in this case, I endorse what F.W. de Klerk is saying. And what F.W. managed to do was to take all of that support and reduce his opposition on the right to a relatively insignificant number. Whereas if he hadn't done that, he might have been in a much more political, you know, same position of more political vulnerability. But anyway, it's just, yeah, the options that are available to leaders and how important it is that they grasp the opportunity to do what's good for the country. To see it and act.
And it's the depressing tendency of South African politics, I think, sometimes to rhyme across the decades, which hopefully we learn our lesson from, and, you know, actually embrace the reforms before we're forced to the point of total crisis and collapse. But anyway,
exactly.
Let's move on to our next one very briefly. On Wednesday, so yesterday, Ramaphosa opened the G20 meeting. He talked about a pro-sustainable and inclusive growth platform. He said South Africa's four priorities for its presidency of the G20 were strengthening disaster support and climate resilience, mobilizing funding for the just energy transition, addressing debt sustainability for the developing world, particularly Africa, and harnessing critical minerals to promote inclusive growth. And you know what? It's difficult to put more buzzwords in a paragraph on foreign policy. I read a lot of foreign policy things, and this is all the buzzwords. And, you know, he makes some reference in his speech to the uncertainties in the world and lack of multilateralism and things. But honestly, the ANC has been saying exactly the same thing forever. And the world does seem to be in a fair amount of turmoil. You've got this growing competition between the Americans and the Chinese. You've got the Europeans and the Americans falling out with each other. You've got just movements all over the place. India is making plays here. And South Africa just seems to sort of be stodgily trudging along in the same path we always have, which is this kind of talky, soft left thing that doesn't go anywhere and just has no kind of oomph behind it. The only oomph that we can summon on is to fight the Israel-Palestine issue on the global front, but without any sort of plan, it seems, of how to actually, you know, protect ourselves from the consequences of getting involved in such a big fight as that. Any thoughts, Michael?
Yeah, I certainly not very much beyond endorsing exactly what you've said. you know, and you imagine a typical ANC supporter kind of reading that and thinking, well, where do I fit into this? What does this really mean to me as a South African, as a member of the globe? You know, this is the man who's kind of representing me internationally. Where do I see myself fitting into this, you know, strengthening disaster support, climate resilience, mobilizing funding for just energy transition, debt sustainability? You know, it's all a bit, as you say, the kind of airy-fairy, neither here nor there-ish, plodding on, and just sort of really out of touch with where we all live.
Why is it a foreign policy objective of South Africa to get, you know, I don't know, Senegal's debt excused by the EU? I mean, this doesn't make our lives better, and yet this is apparently a thing that we're going to be concerned about. It's just once again, Ramaphosa is kind of showing a complete sort of lack of any kind of decisive leadership, I think, and ability to kind of deal with a very uncertain world, even though, you know, he keeps talking about global uncertainty. Okay, brief one, just for our last one, just some developments overseas. Michael, you're a man who's very keen on the health and state of the media around the world, being a man who has a long career in media, in newspapers. Washington Post owner Jeff Bezos has made headlines by announcing that he is in fact revamping the opinion section of the Washington Post, saying that they're going to reorient the paper to be in favor of personal liberties and free markets. He says, quote, "We'll cover other topics too, of course, but viewpoints opposing these pillars will be left to be published by others. There was a time when a newspaper, especially one that was a local monopoly, might have seen it as a service to bring the reader's doorstep every morning, a broad-based opinion section that sought to cover all views. Today, the internet does that job," and he therefore went on to endorse this change. This has caused a lot of fuss within the Washington Post. It's had its opinions editor resign. It's had the source we were reading for this for this story was in fact the Washington Post awkwardly reporting on itself, which is not an easy thing to do. You know, free markets and personal liberties, that's something I can get behind as a message, but there's something about this that doesn't feel great. Michael, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, you know, free markets and personal liberties really comes down to producing a paper that covers every possible thing and any possible thing, and does not take instructions from its owner. You know, that's really a newspaper that promotes those things. So there's a kind of contradiction in terms here. Media owners are very powerful. It costs an enormous amount to buy a single newspaper. To buy a group is, you know, even more so. I think a big paper like Washington Post, you know, we're talking about a mammoth investment, and it's hugely prestigious, a very great lineage of owners. Paper like that, especially with the Watergate saga, is having elevated its prominence in the public consciousness. So it's a major thing, I think, to own a paper like that and to exercise your power as a media, as the owner of that newspaper, that kind of media. Wisely really means exercising enormous restraint, and maybe the biggest power that you confer is on your editors to say, "You publish what you will. That's your job, and I shall not interfere." And that ought to be worn as a real badge of honor by media owners. It's not always. We know from our own peril in this country with independent groups, especially both under the Irish and under Iqbal Survey, and it's not the only one. But it's very critical that media owners exercise that restraint, I think. And it's important to remember that, you know, a liberal newspaper or a paper that's in favor of personal liberties and free markets, freeing of the mind, is really a paper that doesn't take instructions from anybody, and does exactly what its editorials management decide is right. And they, of course, live by that, and sometimes are fired on the same basis. If they don't succeed, then off they go. But that's really the surest guarantee, I think, of sound media.
anyway, interesting developments to watch around the globe, as these are certainly exciting times. The headlines are very full these days of very many things. Anyway, that is all the time we have for today. We hope you found the show interesting, and we will be back tomorrow with the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone. Have a great one. The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.